And welcome back to the Week in Sports Cars on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires and supported this month by our friends at Justice Brothers. Graham Goodwin, again, we're trying something new, I guess, in the week that Pirelli World Challenge announces it's radically altering its format. I don't think it's too radical, but we're going to try a little format altering here and splitting up our Week in Sports Cars insights and analysis and yappity-yappage with the awesome listener-driven Q&A here. So welcome to a new episode of the same episode, or something like that.
Well, I should ask the question, by the way, is who's the pro and who's the am if we're adopting the new rules for Pirelli World Challenge? Or did I read that?
I'm definitely the am here. You're the pro.
I'm in trouble.
Something like that. No, you know what? We're both lead rated. How's that? We are a new classification.
Plumbing the debts.
Exactly. Before we dive in, Graham, let's thank our friends at Justice Brothers once again. Their additives, lubricants, and cleaners are America's brand for quality. Also a huge, huge supporter of motor racing and motor racing teams. If you're interested in joining their sales and distribution team, they offer products for the automotive, semi-truck, agricultural, and industrial markets. If you'd like to learn more, become part of that sales team. Check out their website at justicebrothers.com. We have almost 30 questions on Facebook and plenty on Twitter as well, pal. Let's just kick off straight away with our very first question that came in on the book face, and that was from David Faulkner, who says, Is PwC looking to challenge IMSA's Continental Tire Sports Car Championship Challenge Championship with the GT4 East and West Series, or is their model going to assist GT4 growth in America since it's not a joint/national championship? Interesting one there, David. We have IMSA, which has committed to GT4 being the thing that it loves most in its grand sport, the Conti GS category, starting this year. And I don't know if challenge is the word, being the mindset for the SRO and PwC. It strikes me as them just saying, we're going to do our own thing. Admittedly, Graham, I would say the diversity of models in PwC's GT4 offerings has been, if we're just looking at who has more, I would say PwC has been leading in that regard. So I don't know if the 2019 changes we discussed in the first half of the podcast, which we hope you listen to, I don't know if any of those changes are really aimed at IMSA, since at least in my opinion, they've kind of been the ones out front on this and setting the standard.
Well, I think this first thing to consider is the fact that SRO, who now own Pirelli World Challenge, also own GT4. GT4 is actually a trademarked, not just the phrase, but also the rule book, is owned by SRO. They developed that, and that is a concept that if you're going to run something that says GT4, then you're going to have a license from SRO to do it in exactly the same way as if you're going to call something LMP3, you need to do the same with the ACO. So that's the first thing to take into consideration. As for the East-West side of things, fits perfectly with exactly what they're doing across Europe with GT4, with the Northern and Southern Cup, with the Central European Cup. Also, there's a Belgian Championship that runs under SRO rules, and actually they've been trying to get a Nordic Cup together with some difficulties. So I think they see the opportunity here to grow their entrance base. We talked about this in the other half of the show, with these more accessible, in terms of the finance required, GT4 cars. I think this is part of a longer term commitment. I think this is about getting many into GT racing by effectively converting them from maybe some of those self-built cars that I know of blessed memory across the North American racing scene into something that perhaps is customer sport factory built. With some inherent advantages in terms of the the guaranteed safety levels, some disadvantages in terms of the more homegrown race industry and the race shops up and down the United States that have been a key part of amateur racing for so many years. But this is about, no doubt whatsoever, this is, I don't think this is them taking on anybody. I think this is them looking within and looking outside their current customer base for where they believe they can grow it most effectively and most quickly.
So we have had a couple questions here, Graham, on the Tequila Patron exit one from our friend David Zitterbart down under. Adam Smith as well. Adam wanted to know why they ended. I think we covered that a little bit with the sale of the brand and the fact that Ed, who was the longtime CEO, no longer in place. These kinds of things aren't a big shock. The person who was the proponent, who engaged the brand to spend a lot of money to support motor racing, is no longer atop the business. And unless a similar motor racing nut came in behind, and or the new owners were big supporters of motor racing as well, you could see that the penchant for Ed, by Ed, was probably going to leave with him for motor racing. And that is, to me at least, effectively what has taken place here. David raises a good question, Graham, in mentioning, so we have a team that has been funded, a DPI team, one of four in IMSA, that has been funded by a major company, a lot of money spent, that money's going away. We've been hearing about a possible fifth, possible sixth constructor coming in. And his point was, well, hey, this is very similar to the WEC, which kind of had that going. And then one by one, they went away or things fell apart. Any concerns for you, at least, Graham, that the upcoming split between Patron and ESM could actually jeopardize their program from continuing?
Well, I think there's two or three questions that come from it. As we said in the earlier part of the show, MP, there is a big question here. I mean, Ed Brown was clearly the engine, the driver, financially for this arrangement. But the fact that the new management of his brand have opted to step back indicates two things. One, he's not in control of that decision. But two, that it doesn't actually add up financially. You know, if this was actually selling product, then you could be reasonably assured they continue that pattern. So there are some big questions here to be asked about that product in that customer marketplace without that factory backing or without the kind of the bolstering of someone else behind the scenes actually pulling those strings. So, yeah, I think there certainly are parallels here. Whether or not there's a sustainable marketplace for those customer engines. I think the Patron ESM program was pretty unique. Although, if your story from a couple of weeks back, MP, about Bob Stallings and Hyundai comes forward, wouldn't stay unique. It would be something where, they'd be looking to attract as best involvement from that brand as they possibly could. But that might only be limited, if it comes to fruition, to a customer engine. It's going to be interesting in the next year, particularly year or two, probably, to see just exactly where the DPI market turns. My view, I think we might see a couple of current P2 teams opting to run a customer DPI car. We had that discussion a week or so ago about where those options might be. They're fairly limited in the current marketplace. This move actually may open up that possibility to a little less exclusivity, shall we say, for the customer efforts with the Nissan engine. I have to say, personally, I'm quite attracted to the prospect of effectively a spec chassis with some adjustments for the visuals around the car, with a variety of established race versions of engines, particularly from the GT3 marketplace, where the kind of required 600-650 brake horsepower or so is there or thereabouts available. But I do think we are right now at a moment, I think this is where David is absolutely right, it sort of feels a little bit like one of those moments when the card you were hoping that someone wasn't going to play hits the table. It's going to be very interesting. I really do wish Scott Sharp and his team well. They've added immeasurably to the pleasure and the spectacle of the racing in IMSA over the last several seasons, and it would be a big shame to see them go away or have to kind of reel in, if you like, from their current position. I think they've got a mountain to climb to maintain it, though.
Next question is one where we received our first ever talking points. Unsolicited talking points, Graham, which offline we both agreed was rather interesting. So I guess maybe a compliment in one sense that at least one, maybe more manufacturers read the questions you send in before we address them, and the fact that we got some possible talking points. Also quite interesting. Kevin Frederico, thank you again for always sending in great stuff for us. He says, hey guys, what's the biggest thing holding back the Mazda program? And we assume, referring to the DPI effort run by Yost. They've had a great squad running the program, refigured the chassis, have top-notch driving talent. Is it the AER motor that's been the biggest challenge? You would think from previous iterations like the MZRR motor, they would have plenty of data. I think, Graham, we have multiple things going on here. There have been points, we should mention up front, where they were extremely competitive this year, Kevin, where victory was not too far out of the realm of possibility. Sebring stands out as one where, boy, they were looking good for a stretch there. They've been fast at times, and they have been in the hunt at times. I would say that there's still a few factors that are maybe underestimated. Team Yost, fantastic. We know them. Le Mans winners a zillion times over. All the stuff we already know. They also have not had to run a program under a strict budget in a series where you cannot just make up whatever parts, pieces you want to improve the vehicle. It's been a really long time since they have had to work in this kind of dynamic with so many controls in place. And I would say that there has been a larger and longer learning curve in adapting to the challenge here, running the Mazda program, redeveloping the car, and then going and competing with it as well. I'd say that's the number one thing that stands out to me. And that's not taking a dig at the Yost team. That's just saying this isn't a like-for-like situation where they stepped away from the Audi program at the end of 2016, walked right into the Mazda program, and boy, it was like no time had gone by. There was nothing new to learn. Quite the opposite. On the motor front, we know that at least this year, I believe we have seen more power than ever available from the motor. I think, as I've mentioned before, the twin turbo V6 power plant might be the sweet spot that has emerged this season in IMSA. Last year with the Cadillac Graham, its big old 6.2 liter V8, man, that thing was a raging monster. Having been downsized to 5.5 liters this year, there's still been plenty of winning going on. Not saying it isn't a fantastic motor, but we've also seen Acura Team Penske with their 3.5 liter twin turbo V6 and the Tequila Patron ESM effort with its 3.8 liter twin turbo Nissan. I think those two types of motors, big V8, mid-size twin turbo V6, have really stood out. I'm not saying that Mazda has chosen the wrong motor, but as the only folks with a small displacement four-cylinder turbo, I cannot think of an event where it stood out as the clear advantaged effort in the paddock. That to me is a little bit strange, Graham. So, you know, this is actually kind of insane, brother. We're more than an hour into this conversation. I realize that we've split the Q&A into a separate thing, so we're just, you know, a matter of minutes into this, but we haven't used BOP yet, really. So this is the first. It's taken a long time to get here. I think BOP is definitely something to consider on this topic when we're talking motors. And that of all the DPI engines, this little four banger turbo produced by AER has to work really hard to play with the others And that, again, Graham, that might be the biggest thing that jumps out to me. Of all the IMSA rounds this year where the prototypes have participated, I can think of ones where the Cadillac was clearly the car to beat, where Nissan was clearly the car to beat, where Acura was clearly the car to beat. And since aero changes aren't really a big part of the BOP makeup, as they're applied here in North America, it often comes down to motor BOP strictures. And so that, to me, might be one area where, you know, if we're looking for a weekend where Mazda was given an advantage, or the changes that were made ended up producing an advantage, I would say that would at least put the team equal with what I've seen among the other DPI entrants. What stands out for you as possible reasons why we haven't seen Mazda in victory lane?
Well, here's the good points. By a million miles, it's the best looking prototype out there by a distance. For me, I'll say this and put this on the record. I think that the Mazda program is probably the one that has taken the DPI concept in the direction visually that I hoped it would go. I am personally somewhat underwhelmed with the difference that we've seen for some of the other DPIs over their P2 brethren. That said, I think we expected more by now this year from the program. There is certainly an element where racing luck has not gone their way, but even then, that racing luck is not going their way when they're not perhaps in direct contention for a win. Maybe struggling to get to and keep a podium opportunity, but not in contention directly for an overall win. And I try to find the right words here. It does seem that at times the car is having to be pushed harder than its brethren out there. It does seem that they are having to squeeze proportionately more of the available performance out in any given situation just to stay with the leading crowd. I'm disappointed that we're not able to have celebrated a Mazda win this year. They seem to be getting closer. I would hesitate to point the finger at one part of the package or another, but I have to tell you that if this is supposed to be a balanced performance area in DPI, it doesn't look that balanced to me. It just doesn't.
And that, I guess, that could be received as either a cop out. Or, well, I guess everything we've just said could be taken as nothing but offering of excuses. But that BOP angle is really the one that trumps the entire conversation here. If this is meant to be balanced, then we should have seen more instances where the Mazdas have been up front fighting for podiums. And while there has been a little bit of that, there has not been a lot of that.
And no, indeed.
And so that's why, for me, Kev, this conversation on this specific topic, in theory, could be applied to any DPI manufacturer, depending on how their season had gone. So if this was a case of, good Lord, those Acuras just could not get out of their way. You know, why are they have one podium this year, but man, they just are seemingly rarely in the hunt for a possible win or even a second place. You would say, well, we know the team's good. We know the car has been highly developed and we know the drivers are good. So what's the other thing that could possibly be limiting them? Well, we could say that about Cadillacs if they were the ones, or Nissan. At this stage, I can say, do I look at every single driver in the Mazda lineup and believe that they are the exact measure of an Elio Castroneves, Felipe Albuquerque, Dane Cameron, Ryan Dial? No, I'd be lying. There's still some youthful development and youthful growth that needs to take place among a couple of Mazda's drivers, but for the most part, by and large, if we can look at the JDC Miller Gainsco team winning at Watkins Glen in a WEC P2 with a Pro-Am lineup. If we can look at Core Autosport winning at CTMP with the probably the most heavily tilted Pro-Am lineup in prototype, it would not be strange to suggest that a fully pro effort fielded by Mazda, or again, if it were any other manufacturer, not having the, you know, really being in a favorable position right now in terms of BOP, you would think that a fully pro Mazda or Acura or whatever else would not be watching one specific model walk away whatever round. But that is kind of sort of what we've seen happen a number of times this year. So I guess maybe it just brings us back to the point, Graham, that if you are balancing, unless you were doing a perfect job, which is an unreasonable expectation, there is going to be someone or someone's feeling as if, hey, we're getting stepped on. We're the ones, we're the support. We are the footbridge for those who are walking to collect their big trophies. So not so much fun there. Let me grab one here. Graham from Michael Hogan says, hey, Marshall, what's the reasoning behind the prototypes not going to VIR? I hear you, Michael. Adding in the prototypes to VIR would be, I think, just insane. Absolute insane fun. We did see back in the Grand Am, the Rolex sports car series, that the Daytona prototypes did go. They weren't particularly fast or impressive, but the DPIs weren't, or the DPs weren't particularly fast or impressive anywhere. This has just become a thing. Honestly, and since IMSA does not send all three of its classes to every single round, some are on, some are off, depending on the event. Yeah, I'd love to see prototypes there, but as I mentioned in the analysis, the first portion of our podcast this week, I do love the two GT-only events, so at least for me, I'm not crying for prototypes to be added in at VIR. I think a GT Fest is all kinds of awesome. Do you want to take the next one, Graham, from Shay Adam?
Just add a quick point to that one, which is that it's a point that's been made repeatedly in the WEC, that the GT-only format does give those manufacturers an opportunity to win overall. And that's, you know, that's a hard-fought battle for those GTLM factories and something that, you know, they've been asking for, the fans have been asking for some considerable time. I'm of the opinion that it would be great to see the same occur in some way with the WEC GT factories, in some way, not on the horizon immediately. This Shay Adam character, she does hang around a bit, boy, doesn't she, on this?
Little clingy.
Yeah. Needy, I think is the word, needy. Apologizing for the lack of the question last week. She was apparently fighting off a wild bear who was eating all the wild salmon from the rivers in Canada. I think it's just overemphasizing the point, isn't it, really? Two questions for this week. What song, when it comes on the radio, gives you a fantastic racing memory? What memory and why? Let's take that one first.
Let's see. The fantastic memory. This is somewhat recent, and it might have been... it actually isn't sports car related, but this is a first one that popped into mind. I got into the habit about maybe 5 years ago at Indianapolis, maybe four, covering the Indy 500, singing, and I apologize, I'm forgetting whether it's David Byrne as a solo artist or the Talking Heads, but, we're on the road to nowhere.
That's the Talking Heads.
All right. Was just singing that. Found myself singing that repeatedly in the media center when, I believe, prior to IndyCar's current administration, its previous administration was finding new and inventive ways to shoot itself in the foot with dumb decisions. And so it just started singing that. And I can't say that it was just purely reactionary and I didn't know what I was singing, but it wasn't a super... like conscious decision. And then I heard my pal and colleague Robin Miller sitting, you know, next to me, just starting to sing it or hum it on his own when I wasn't. I was like, oh, well, that's not a very good thing. I guess we're maybe being a little aggro towards IndyCar here, just doing our job, singing that we believe they're on the road to nowhere. And we were wrong. I mean, they were making some dumb decisions, I believe, aero-wise, and had cars flying and whatnot. But yeah, so that stands out from a couple of years ago. And I must admit, whenever something silly is done or happens from a series standpoint, Graham, while I'm out of track, that soundtrack does start to pop up.
Well, there you go. For me, it's one from back in the day when I still cared about Formula One and the happy days of Murray Walker as a commentator, and the BBC's theme tune was The Chain by Fleetwood Mac, and that still is very evocative. But the other one, it's not one I have to tell you that I've heard on the radio for some time, comes from a bit of leg pulling back in the day for my now so very sadly late friend, the always very awesome Alan Simonson, and I used to whistle There Is Nothing Like a Dame with a difference between the M and the N. So the There Is Nothing Like a Dane comes directly from me leg pulling Alan Simonson over a period of years, and whenever I hear that song, I do think of Alan. Yes. Shay does ask another question. Almost all racing drivers like planes for some reason. I don't know about that so much. It may be the fast variety, but not sitting on them. You're put in charge of casting Top Gun 2. What drivers do you place as Maverick, Goose, and Iceman?
Yeah, you might have to go first on this
one. I'm going to go for this one. Maverick, well, like Goose, who's that kind of, it was a slightly kind of, Maverick would be Lawrence Vanture, without a doubt.
Ooh.
Goose, Nicky Team, an Iceman who was the massively talented but somehow quite irritating one, Juan Pablo Montoya.
Wow, because I would go the other way around. I would say Montoya as Maverick, because you get that guy, he is a man steeped in confidence, doesn't give a bleep about what anyone thinks, and tells everybody how to do their job better than they could possibly know how to do it. So I would stick JPM in there. As for Goose, who's kind of in that court jestery role, I mean, I guess the default would be Jordan Taylor, but I'll go with Ryan Deal there, because there is a genuine source of fun and mischief inside Goose. As for the Iceman, that's the one where I'm drawing a little bit of a blank. I think I might only have the first two here. Dear listeners, please help me out here. Please help complete this. I've failed on coming up with Iceman among the sports car paddock for Top Gun 2 casting. So please tweet or Facebook your thoughts on who should be nominated.
Right, we'll go with Michael Wallace. Builds on the theme we've been building through the two halves of this question, just as my PC goes to sleep on me. And it's to do with the current, not uncertainty, but moves from PwC. Two-part question. Do you guys think, with the changes coming to PwC, will teams leave and go to the WeatherTech Championship or CTSC? How different is a GT4 budget and a GT3 budget between IMSA and PwC? Oof. Difference between a GT4 budget and a GT3 budget is simply massive, and not least of the initial purchase cost for the cars. Do I think we'll see some people move between? I inevitably think we will. I think we will see people think, I don't like that template, let's try elsewhere. But I'll go back again to what I said earlier, which is I don't think those moves would have been made without a fair degree of confidence that their current competitors at least are in support of them. I wouldn't expect to see a wholesale, you know, pack up camp and go and circle the wagons elsewhere. I would expect, as we've seen for time immemorial, the odd team to kind of have a sniff around the edges of the paddock elsewhere to see whether or not they like the scent.
I'm going to skip down to Tim Same, another friend writing in from Australia, who follows the fun and mirth-laden line of questions. What's one team in sports car racing history who deserves their own Netflix series, and who would you cast in the lead role? Tim says, I'd cast Josh Brolin as Jim Hall for winging it, the Chaparral story. Tim, that's awesome. You might have answered the question for us here.
I think he has answered the question.
Yeah, that
I don't think you go any further than that, other than perhaps somebody doing something about the Porsche story. Who would play Norbert Singer in that?
Gosh, I don't know why I'm brain farting today. There's one... I'm not sure if he's Irish or English actor. He was in the movie... I'm forgetting the name of that movie as well. Good Lord, I need to eat my brainios before we record next time. Because my brain... In Bruges, I think was the name of the movie with Colin Farrell,
yes.
Who played his cohort. Was it Brendan... let me find here. Brendan Gleeson, I think, would be the perfect Norbert Singer. The
wouldn't
look-alike.
He just?
I don't know if he'd be keen on the German accent, but that would be just
I
fine.
Think he can well.
You know, Tim, I've mentioned before on the Week in Sports Cars that my friends at Adam Carolla's production company, my pal Nate Adams, who recently did the Willie T. Ribbs documentary, and before that the Paul Newman documentary, that they were looking to do, or at least had an interest in doing, a documentary on IMSA and its narco-fueled portion of the 1980s with Randy Lanier, the Woodington brothers, the Paul, John Paul Sr. primarily. It would almost have to be a Netflix series, multiple entries there. I think that would be fascinating. I hope they do it. I've always wanted to do that. I've also honestly always wanted to do an IMSA documentary. But I would say, you know, probably the one that stands out and probably many would think would be ripe for such a thing would be a Level 5 documentary. I don't know if we would get Mike Myers spooled up in Dr. Evil garb with a wig being Scott Tucker. But I would think that, you know, a Level 5 thing would be a blast. But
Nick Cage would be Scott Tucker.
Oh, there we go. That's perfect right there. I can mention, and this is, I guess, a little bit related, but Jeff Brown, old friend, who is the engineer for so much of what went on at Level 5, and also the now famous D Sports Racing Project, which was the subject of the best work ever created by Dinner with Racers, Ryan Eversley and Sean Heckman. Jeff reached out, I don't know, maybe a couple weeks ago, a month ago, and said, hey, you know what would be really fun to do? It would be written features, maybe a podcast as well, getting into the technical side of that vehicle and how it was created, how some of what they did in developing that car with Multimatic, some of those processes and procedures were really the forerunner and maybe foundation layer for what Multimatic did in developing the Ford GT. So looking to do, again, probably a combo of both podcast and written pieces, more on the technical angle, just diving into that insane D Sports Racer that Scott Tucker funded and did pretty amazing things with there. But yeah, it's pretty... To me, it's interesting, Tim, as someone who covers both open-wheel racing with IndyCar and sports cars in a variety of championships, I can think of far more sports car racing documentaries, history pieces, and whatnot that are deserving from an ALMS, IMSA, Grand Am, WEC, blah, 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 than anywhere else. So it's a great question, and don't be afraid to ask it again, because we'll probably keep coming up with ideas, although I think you won with winging it, the Chaparral story. Josh Brolin might need to get a bit taller because good old Jim was rather imposing there.
That's certainly one MP where the listeners can actually go to the Facebook page and actually offer their own point of view.
Yes.
There's a long question here from Doug Bonham, which basically relates to GT3, and putting that one together, what he's basically saying is the growth of GT3 stymieing factory involvement in sports car racing. Are we doing effectively too much to pander to the pro-am nature of the sport? Have to say, I think it's a really, really good question. I think the answer to the first part is inevitably yes. If a manufacturer is making money in one area of the sport, they're somehow proportionally less likely to spend it elsewhere. Though Porsche did historically use their customer sports budget to actually fund other motorsport programs. Are we going too far to keep teams and gentlemen drivers happy? I think we've reached that point. I think we have got to the stage where we do need to take another look. I had a long chat with David Heimeyer Hansen about exactly this at Watkins Glen offline. And, you know, David's got some well-formed views on that from the perspective of being someone who does spend a lot of money on motorsport. I think it's right that we should treat the gentleman drivers, the guys actually funding not just their own drives, let's not forget, but in very many instances, cars, teams, other professional drivers, very many of whom would not have had the careers that they've had without that focus. But I do think there needs to be a pretty open debate about how healthy that is moving forward and where the, if you like, the power base should lie. I think it's a very good question, Doug. I think we've got to the point where that that debate is probably a little overdue.
Fun little sidebar here. Just got an email from one from the proprietor of Lowlander Sports Limited, one A. McNish.
Never heard of him.
Yeah, forwarding a little note here from someone who had apparently heard about an interview he and I did about his 1998 Le Mans victory, 20th anniversary.
Oh, him!
Of that. Yes,
him.
That guy.
Short guy, Scottish.
And Alan's helmet painter, is the person asking the question, wanted to know where he might find that to listen to it. So look at that. We even have good old Al helping to drive traffic, or at least one listen, I should say, to our sports car podcasts here, my friend.
Oh, by the way, all joking aside, congratulations to Alan and the Audi team
for the championship
win.
Brilliant.
Yep.
A fluke, though. They should definitely fire the Formula E sporting director there at the Ford
team director, team principal. Terrible.
Complete fluke. Yeah. Let's see. I'm going to bounce around a little bit here to grab some more Facebook questions, Graham, knowing that we are going to wind down here shortly. And we also have some Twitter questions I'd love you to take once I dive off or hand you the baton here. Nicole Bitzer, the TCR class, is there any possibility that could grow in any way? I definitely think so, Nicole, and this is going to drive right into the second question we're going to get to on this topic. I believe there is potential for great growth here. Coming back to the promotion side, I still think that we could benefit on the, just strictly speaking, North America, we could benefit on the PWC side and the IMSA side within the Conti series on the exact costs, what you get in terms of sessions, etc. I believe it's a class that could really explode in terms of popularity, but I don't know if there's the value to be found there, Graham. I don't know if that is being fully amplified due to the massive number of options in so many other classes that are vaguely similar. GTS, GT4, TCR, TCA, STG. I mean, you can get lost in acronyms pretty quickly. For those that might want to buy one or might be looking for something in that general sphere to purchase, I think TCR would end up being a really popular go-to thing. Mm-hmm. I just don't know if there's full communication on that awesomeness and what you would get, where you can race it, if you went with it. And then I'm going to chase this up with a question from Jason Hyde and saying, is there a BOP issue with the TCR class in PWC or the real-time Civic Type Rs and Brian Herta's Hyundais with the drivers? You know, are they just a stronger overall effort with the drivers in the cars? And then obviously Jason pointed out the fact that, you know, barring anything I'm forgetting at the moment, this has effectively been the real-time racing and Brian Herta Autosport TCR class presented by Pirelli World Challenge with Ryan doing some awesome winning in his Honda and Herta's drivers, Mark Wilkins and such, winning in the Hyundais. wanting to know, is this a BOP thing? What is causing this fairly heavy tilt? In a conversation that I had, a video piece that went up on Racer.com with PwC CEO Greg Gill at Road America, he pointed to the fact that they are still working off of European TCR kind of BOP guidelines, which he believed did not properly address some of the vehicular differences between this model or that model, and that there could be some areas to improve from the series standpoint on the technical side to better balance the cars. I don't disagree with that, and I do believe that that certainly has merit. But coming back to this point of what might be coming next year, we don't know, strictly enforcing the customer aspect of TCR. I mean, look, Ryan Eversley might not be someone that I'm going to throw into a DPI and expect him to beat some of the names that we mentioned before, the Joao Barbosas and the Ricky Taylors and whatnot. But you put that guy in a GT car, we have seen the guy is a monster. Drop him down into a TCR car, and this is also someone in Ryan who, if we're talking front-wheel drive talent, Graham, that this guy is pretty badass. You also take a Brian Herta team, a guy like Mark Wilkins, who, again, I just supremely talented, and then you put them up against people in other models. Heck, I would say even the same models. And these guys are going to come out on top with Real Time Racing, with Brian Herta Autosport. Those are two teams in TCR that, apologies to anyone who feelings might be hurt, they're better than the rest. And then you drop in drivers who are better than the rest, and they're going to win. So I would say
I guess it's a matter of what do you want.
And that's not
do
a negative. Want... That, and nothing no, I'm saying I mean, is negative. It's just,
you know, I agree.
Of course they're winning. They're better.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there is that part. It kind of plays back, doesn't it, to that question we just asked about, you know, have we gone too far in relation to the pro-am aspect of it? What do you want to see when you go motor racing? Do you want to see the best winning? Or do you want something that's so managed that, you know, it's because you inevitably manage things back to a level, not forward. And to me, there is huge pleasure. I mean, look at Ryan Eversley, you're absolutely right. Monstrous talent in a GT car and in the TCR car. Great broadcast as well. If only he had good looks, he'd be the perfect package.
I know.
It's tragic, really. Oh, but you know, that for me, that's the debate. That's where the debate lies at the moment with sports car racing, endurance racing. Are we taking this balancing too far? Why do we always have to dumb things down? It effectively plays all the way through here to the DPI LMP2 debate, to Toyota and the non-hybrid debate. You know, should we be balancing the Toyota back to the performance, potential performance of those non-hybrid cars? Or should the non-hybrid cars be left in a situation where they're effectively waiting for the only factory cars in the grid to break? It's an open debate. I'm not offering a widespread opinion about all of it. I would say that in general, I think we've gone too far with trying to balance everything. When I go and watch a motor race, I want to watch the best of the best doing what they possibly can to get as much performance as they can out of the package they've got. And if they break the car doing that, they've gone too far. That's the reality of motorsport as I've always known it. And it does seem to me at the moment, MP, that we speak too much about balance and not enough about excellence.
I can't disagree with any of that. The takeaway I have on this very specific topic, Jason, which we will find out the answer to here shortly, what does PwC and the SRO envision for its TCR class? Is it meant to be something where pro teams, pro drivers intermingle with amateur teams and amateur drivers? That is what we have right now. We did see in the press release that they appear to want to alter that, as they've done with GT. But if that's the case, then this is going to be the season where the Eversleys and Wilkins and Real Times and Brian Herta's really just run roughshod over everyone. And then come next year, based on driver ratings, possibly, whatever, you know, filtering out the pros and also filtering out teams, possibly. I don't know how you police factory involvement. You know, you can say, all right, well, you must have a bronze or silver driver. You go, okay, so maybe we don't have a pro driver, but are we going to give you access to our bank accounts to see whether pick whichever manufacturer is sending us money? I don't know if we would ever get to that level, but you know, barring pushing the pro teams out and pro drivers out, you're always going to have this dynamic where if it's open and undefined, a manufacturer with a model in that category is probably going to want to show up and probably want to win and then promote that they're winning with their product to get you to go buy the road version of that vehicle. If this is something that PwC and the SRO decides, hey, we no longer want this at the TCR level, then that's their decision to make, and we will see. What the thing that I struggle with, Graham, on this subject is when we have what's going on right now, where if you and I decide to buy a TCR model and go race it, hopefully in 1/18th scale rather than 1/43rd, those are a bit hard to race, then there should be a consideration for those amateurs who decide that they want to be a part and would like the possibility of being successful. It's expectations and managing those expectations. And again, if we have something where there are no rules saying that pro teams, pro drivers can't come in to one of the mid-tier sports car classes, you can't get upset that they're winning because that's what they're supposed to do. But you also have to ask questions of future health and future growth. And would that dynamic run off those who either have TCRs, TCR cars, to want to go try maybe IMSA, for example, in the Conti series, or just say the heck with this altogether? So I know that isn't so much a sporting question, more one of, hey, I've spent money on a race car, and gosh and golly, I want to win, and or at least get on the podium, and all of these pro teams make it impossible. Well, again, it's that question of what does the series want for itself? There's no situation where amateurs should beat pros, and so do you safeguard that, knowing that there may be more amateurs who would want to come in to populate the class, or do you want to go all in with pro TCR efforts? So PwC is going to tell us here very shortly on how they plan on structuring that class, and who knows, this might be a one and done for Ryan and others who are pro grade and doing the vast majority of the victory champagne spraying. You want to jump over to Twitter for a couple questions, Graham?
Well, I've got one just to have a look at here. It's a quite a simple one to answer. Steve Kowalczyk asks a couple of questions, one of which is, are there any rules regarding maximum ICE and minimum hybrid sizes in LMP1? Could you game the system by sticking in a tiny hybrid system, take advantage of the top-end speed of non-hybrid cars with longer stints and shorter pit stops given to hybrids, lower or even no reliance on this hybrid unit could mean lower costs, develop an increased reliability, it's under little stress, blah, blah, blah. On the face of it, absolutely brilliant question. The only point at which that falls is that it ignores completely the fact that if you've got the hybrid, if you're in that hybrid subclass, if you like, you get about half the fuel in those stints. So you would be actually gaining a massive disadvantage in that you would not be able to run with the full performance of the non-hybrid car, Steve. So that's why that would not work, because the message is supposed to be about efficiency, not just because it's been gamed, if you like, to give them that false one-lap gap, but they're getting that one-lap gap despite the fact they're actually carrying something like 55% of the fuel load of the non-hybrid car. So that one simply wouldn't work. I've lost my Twitter feed for the moment, MP, so I'm going to have to stick with Facebook. After Romain Dumas' performance at Pikes Peak, this is Steve's other question on Goodwood. Can a vehicle with only electric drive or some kind of onboard generator to top up the batteries, or even a battery capable of running a 9 to 11 lap stint at Le Mans, be quickly changed during a pit stop, be very far off? Well, Mr. Panels and Friends were looking at potentially doing that, weren't they, as early as this year with the Garage 56. I don't think we're a million miles away from it. I think we're away from it. It is going to have to be something around quick change battery packs that would be the only way of doing that. I know we've talked about that on the show before. As technology moves forward, that becomes more and more of a viable prospect. But I think there's a big, big difference between the blinding speed we've seen from Romain Dumas in that VW IDR car and that being anywhere remotely close yet to being something which would be deliverable for an endurance race car. The gap will inevitably close and close quickly. Before VW, we had Paul Drayson's efforts with the complete rebuild he did on his XLMP1 Lola. Yep. I know Paul was talking about effectively the hot charging, if you like, with pads either on the track or underneath the track surface, a little like the more modern way of wireless charging your mobile phone. We're not a million miles away from it. We may have in LMP1 terms to wait for 2024 and the proposals that we're expecting to hear more about post the hypercar regulations that come for 2020, 2021 for a zero emissions formula that will come for the next batch of regulations, widely expected to encourage development of hydrogen as the main fuel source. But I don't think we're quite there yet. But the fact that we can start to get excited about the performance potential of an EV, I think takes us forward somewhat. Will we mourn the passing of some aspects of more traditional motorsport? Yes. But when you start to see the performance advantages of those kind of powertrains, that we're not talking about compromise, we're talking about, you know, eyeball searing potential performance, then all of a sudden it becomes a little bit easier for the old soaks like me to take.
Throw in two quick things in this, Graham, and then I'll grab a couple more Facebook items, and then we're going to try and wind down here. On the topic of quickly serviceable, changeable battery packs, definitely worth noting that if we're talking about a fully EV vehicle or a vehicle just that is exceptionally EV-based with maybe a minor internal combustion engine component to its overall propulsion, we're talking about big weight with batteries. So oh, yeah. We're talking about quick, there's quick. That would be a definite challenge due to the mass and weight that had to be moved in and out, disconnected, and then reconnected, but also the placement. I know that looking at the Panos, the green-for-you-based car that they're wanting to put together, in the renderings, they had a cartridge-style system that slid out from the side of the car, and I'm not saying that couldn't work. I'm not pretending to be an expert on this subject of that vehicle's specific design, but knowing that there are crash standards, I mean, most often it's forward or rearward crash structure standards, but also there are side impact standards. Packing huge amount of batteries on the far extremes of the car, on the far right, far left, where the side pods would be normally, if we're thinking in prototype terms, front or back, I would say it would be unlikely from a design standpoint that this large battery pack weighing hundreds of kilos, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pounds, if not more, would be placed somewhere that could just be easily ka-chunk, disconnected and plugged back in. It would probably be more centrally mounted or in the back of a prototype where, you know, at least for solutions that come to mind that also include safety standards that might not be as readily disconnectable as one would like. Other thing that jumps out here too, Graham, and I know this might sound dumb, and it probably is dumb, but as we head more towards electrification in our streetcars, and we would assume would become a greater portion of the automotive racing that we love, if we do get to a point where EV classes, EV series are more the norm, and the only time you hear lots of internal combustion engines are at vintage racing events, it does strike me that we have options for sound. It doesn't have to be a silent world. And again, this is probably dumb, but as someone who is obviously in love with the sound of internal combustion engines, you and I both do what all we can to record ambient and in-car sounds as well. Would it be too crazy to suggest that if, as we do move more towards all-electric racing, that teams could pick what engine notes they wanted, and, you know, speakers, readily available speakers, and sound systems, you know, I mean, come on. Hey, for this race, we are going to use a triple rotor Mazda soundtrack. maybe that could be a money generating thing, Graham, for sanctioning bodies. All right. Who top dollar for the Jaguar V12, SPC or whatever motor or GTP motor. I don't know. That could be a fun kind of price tag. Who's going to pony up the most for the best sounds?
I think I'm correct, aren't I? The BMW i8, a fantastic piece of engineering, an amazing looking car, by the way, that has some kind of sound synthesis that gives the driver and passenger a completely different soundtrack to anybody that's listening to the car from outside. And I can remember back in the 1980s, reading something in Car Magazine, then in its pomp, with Lotus actually offering the option, potentially, through your in-car entertainment system, of choosing effectively what your Lotus Turbo Esprit, fantastic performing car, perhaps not the most inspiring soundtrack from the 2.2-litre turbo, what it sounded like. Would it be a roaring V8? Would it be a screaming V6 or V12? You know, that technology is available. It's a sort of light-hearted response to it, but bearing in mind, if you listen to what the fan base says, that the sound of motorsport is extremely important. And I have to tell you that one of the things that I fundamentally don't like about Formula E is the kind of pounding music soundtrack. That doesn't do it for me at all. In the same way that the Spa 24 Hours, they do have a predilection for pumping out, you know, French and Belgian dance music at 3 o'clock in the morning. No, guys, really sorry, just doesn't do it for me. You know, it is a question worth considering. What do you want to retain from old school motorsport that you think might not be available in the new and coming eras? And if the sound of it is one of those things, then, well, let's face it, if we're in an era where fan boost is a thing, joking aside, why not a soundtrack? Why not?
Absolutely. And maybe this is where we make our billions. And I don't want to say retire. I think, well, it's a good question, Graham. So you and I both, our families, we become wealthy beyond measure. Do we still do this podcast every week?
Fun.
Yeah, I do. I think we do too.
It's fun. You know, at the end of the day, listen, what we do, we are privileged in what we do with the access we get. We're privileged with all of that. It doesn't feel like that sometimes at 4 o'clock.
There's all the travel. And
it's so glamorous.
I'm sorry. I was about to fall the whinging of another member of the sports car reporting pool. Yeah, but then you've got to go to, like, China and Australia.
No one's put a gun to my head making me go.
And then the drink. And then there's people, and then you've got to, like, work, and then there's car. I mean, you know, it's possible. It's just one step away from slavery. So
I've got one here that I'm going to back at, and I quite like this one. It's to do with the 24 Hours of Le Mans.
Bring it, sucker. I know where we're going.
This is who wins 24 Hour Le Mans head-to-head. The racer crew or the DSC crew?
Oh, you should just bend the knee right now, sucker. Trust me, there is nothing more powerful than a team assembled and run by Marshall Pruitt, Paul Fanner, Robin Miller, and the rest of the racer gang. Well, actually,
Yeah.
I'm so good at
Old guys.
that. I'm now a reporter. I don't
Yeah.
know. The thing is, I mean,
Just kidding,
granted,
old guys.
you've got some great photographers on your team. There's a strong DIY ethic between Lordy and Pedro and so on. You guys actually, I think, would be a solid pit crew for our team, which doesn't really answer the question, but I would just say, I would think Paul Fanner, founder, owner of Racer, awesome human being, former racer himself in Formula Ford. Robin obviously worked for IndyCar teams, was a racer as well in Formula Fords, midgets, short track racing and such. And so I think experience wise, I think we have you covered. Plus, and it's not, I haven't put this on my resume, Graham. Maybe I should. I'm an entrant, a one-time entrant in the 24 Hours of Le Mans in 2007, which was one of their earlier events. Entered a front-wheel drive Toyota Corolla, which was a mild, mild piece of garbage engineering. And other than whatever 1987 version of electronics it had that kept cutting out the engine. If not for that, we actually would have done fairly well because I put one of my pro drivers in Gary Sheehan, who was just destroying folks in this little 130 horsepower turd box. But yeah, I've done it.
You
And
made your point. You
yeah,
made your point. You made your case. Now
I'm just
listen to this.
enjoying,
Listen
but
to
I'm just
this.
enjoying talking smack.
No, listen to this. Hang on. Can you listen?
Okay,
Hang on.
I'll
I'm
try.
trying to. Hang on. That's me opening up a can of whoop ass.
Oh, bring it!
Because you may have some, albeit semi-retired talent. We've just got ambition. We've got kart racers. I was a kart racer briefly.
Mario Kart, yeah, video
Yeah,
game.
till I broke my neck. But we've got, he may be slightly grey around the gills. David Lord, fearsome kart competitor.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, he may be, how can we put this, not the most svelte, but fearsome kart competitor in Stephen Kilby. Pedro, you will not find anybody capable of getting from point A to point B quicker by any means possible than Peter Pedro May. I reckon pair of 1986 Toyota Corollas, we'd take you, no problem at all. We'd take you.
All right. I mean, what I'm hearing is there needs to be some sort of crowdsourced funding,
Absolutely.
because these are $500 vehicles, obviously. There's no way
I've not got
you
that
could
far.
afford
I'll just
such a
check.
thing.
Hang on.
But
I'll just check in that can of whoop ass, which, by the way, is actually filled up with every US penny I've ever had. About $3 in there. wouldn't that be fun? Wouldn't that be the best fun?
I think there's something here, dear listener. If you like the idea of a racer versus daily sports car, 24 Hours of Le Mans showdown, this might be stoked into something that happens. And it's also worth mentioning, I probably don't do this enough, Graham, that although my primary focus every day is racer and your primary focus every day is daily sports car, these two organizations work together and collaborate,
Oh, we
which
do.
is a wonderful thing. So this would be a friendly competition, although that
Well,
statement's a
briefly.
complete lie because the minute I had you in my sight, I'd be telling my guys to hammer the wheels
Take
off
him
of
out.
your
Take him
car.
out.
So, but I think this needs to happen. This need, and I might pull in a ringer if we did this in the Bay Area. I might pull in a ringer or two, like Mike Hedlund. Jerry Hildebrand has since moved to Colorado, but I could maybe get him for the week, and I'd put him in disguise. We'd come up with fake names, but yeah, I'm liking this. We need to make this happen. Well, let me grab a couple more here. Then I'm already on my own overtime and needing to get out the door for Monterey to cover the announcement there of IndyCar, which we believe is headed back. So one thing we do is ask not just for questions, but also for you to share your thoughts and opinions. And Ryan Terpstra offered one here that I wanted to share. It's a totally off the list of topics you have, but here goes. I have a solution to the safety car problem at Le Mans, and I can write the rule in one paragraph per Mr. Goodwin. It can't be too complicated. When the safety car with Thank a you. Class leader approaches pit lane, all cars in that class pass through pit lane and park in the warm-up lane, which probably needs to be built. Pit service is allowed. Once all three safety cars have dispatched the entire class cars, we'll resume pacing behind the third safety car. This may require four safety car laps, depending on if you try to double up the classes. Cars that are ahead of the class leader in a given safety car queue do not need to traverse the pit lane at all. Effectively, they restart one-third of a lap behind their class. They gain some, but not a ton, and they don't get to pit. Cars behind the third safety car may not want to pit, as they may not be to the back of the queue in time to resume pacing. This limits their advantage gained as well. It isn't a perfect system, but it doesn't allow anyone to gain too much time, and cars at the front of the class are assured they won't be disadvantaged. Finally, they can't line up on pit lane because cars are pitting towards pit exit, can't exactly line up appropriately. I got lost after about the third or fourth sentence here. But you have like, your brain one, functions one, properly.
I'll offer one very quick response to it, which is I do think the whole problem needs a real rethink. There is no perfect system out there. There just isn't. The IMSA system is better than it was, but it's flawed in a different way to the system used by the WEC and at Le Mans. The big problem when you're talking about two, three, four laps at Le Mans is that's one hell of a long time. You know, a safety car lap, you know, it's a 3 minutes 30 lap at pace. When you add in a full safety car lap and then another and another, you're talking about a very considerable time behind a safety car to affect that one purpose. It may not need the whole thing, but I do think that the general debate about how you manage that is something where, you know what, here's an opportunity. Even if we don't get to the stage where IMSA and the WEC can find a way forward with the regulations for the top class of prototypes, wouldn't it be great to see some kind of summit conference between those organizations and anybody else who wanted to play to come together and just talk about their experience, talk about anything else they've observed out there in the great world of motorsports and come up with some better solutions? Because nobody wants their race or the race that they're keen on following to have that level of external factor ruin it 40 minutes into a 24-hour race. You know, there are good and bad points to every single system I've ever seen. But I think this is one where the great racing family and industry probably needs to put their heads together.
Let me throw this out here, and this is my own most recent thought on the topic, because this can ruin the quality of racing at Le Mans very quickly. We saw that happen this year, where we essentially baked in the GT Le Mans results just far too early. This would require a change in overall philosophy by the ACO and WEC. I know that one thing that gets panned as I listen each year is the American approach to handling cautions, which is to clump and cluster the classes together, have them pit, and resume the race with the cars in order of how they come out of the pits in each class. At the 24 Hours of Le Mans, we have two things going on. Track length, as you mentioned, Graham, 8.5 miles long. We would need three pit lanes spread throughout the track to really try and keep things vaguely fair if we wanted to go that direction. At 8.5 miles, if we're going to have a safety car situation, not a slow zone situation, but actual safety car, it probably suggests that there is a big or bigger issue at hand. If you're going to dispatch a safety car, it's probably not going to be for something that only needs 90 seconds of attention at wherever it is the problem's resolved and back to racing. It tends to be something that is going to chew up some time when a call for safety cars comes out. So knowing that up front, Graham, we've committed to, we're going to be down for a little bit if we decide a situation needs safety cars to get the event under control. So we've taken that. Time is going to be consumed here with safety cars. Great. Well, if circulating the track, this big track, up to three safety cars, teams getting caught in a little bit by happenstance as to where the pace cars come out and which group they fall into, when they might be able to get onto pit lane or not. I would say this, and maybe it's crazy, but it does seem to bring a little bit of the American mindset in. How about everybody pits? And meaning everybody comes onto pit lane, performs service in every single class, and race director Eduardo Freitas says this is the order in which the safety car period started with GTE AM. This was the running order. Great. Everybody perform your services, and we will head back out in that order. Now, I realize that we have a situation where you have created an American restart with the class bunched up and going racing again. That's the one thing that doesn't happen here. And I realize that that might be beyond the comfort zone of some. I can tell you that from purely an entertainment standpoint, that's where you get a lot of action and fun watching an IndyCar race, watching an IMSA race, watching World Challenge, you name it. Restarts is where you get a lot of action, a lot of fun, and entertainment. And so I think the concept of actually trying to entertain fans more, not they're doing something crazy. I mean, the cars pitted in this exact order. The cars were running in this order, and they're going back out in that order. There's nothing artificial about that. You're just simply saying, okay, we're going to try and strip away the big disadvantages that befall some by just pure chance on where they were on track and which pace car they happened to fall behind. If that is unfair and unfairly damaging folks' ability to compete for a podium and or win, I know this is a little bit of an extreme solution, but the idea of saying everybody pit now and then we will dispatch you in the specific order we tell you and line up behind the pace cars, you're maintaining order and control. You're also maintaining accuracy of how the race was paused with cars in the specific order they were running at that time. You know that time is being committed to fixing whatever it is because it's a pace car situation, Graham. And then you resume racing once everyone has completed their stops and goes back to green like we see being done here. Think that's too crazy for a European model?
No, I think, you know, I think we need to consider all options. I think we really do need to consider all options. But pretty clearly, in an era at the moment where the vast majority of factory interest at Le Mans is in the GT class, to actually allow the overall race order to effectively determine the likely direction that that race is going to go as early as it did with the first safety car, clearly that's not sustainable. It's not conducive, is it, to keeping those factories happy? And that is extremely important for the commercial viability of that event, quite aside from our enjoyment of it. But you know, I just think, you know, some things that we currently now regard as being normal, things like virtual safety cars, 60, you know, a kind of slow zones, etc., would have been inconceivable even 10 years ago. You know, we have now got technology that will allow the race to be managed, excuse me, in terms of safety and other things, in very many ways more than would have been possible. And I just think, why not? Why not actually run a simulation of that? See what that actually gives you. That's the other part of this. You don't have to wait till the next race to see how these things pan out. You can simulate it. Try it. Engage with the e-racing community, the online racing community. Get them to trial some of these things. You know, we've got numerous championships which we hold dear that are running with their own online racing competitions. Get them to trial these ideas there first. doesn't that strike you as being something worthwhile that you'll be able to actually find, because there's some clever people involved in online racing, that gives you that opportunity to trial and find where the opportunities to get around that rule book might exist? Strikes me as being perfectly sensible to use every bit of technology we've got at our disposal before we actually finally throw it at a event that's watched by billions around the world and find out that we've actually come up with the wrong solution.
No, that's a brilliant point, Graham. That really is. I hadn't thought about the trialing aspect as well. And yeah, I'll just close on this. One of the arguments that I hear for sticking with the current format and for panning the American approach to such things is it maintains the purity, right? We're not artificially packing up cars. If there was a 14-second gap between fifth place and sixth place, then, you know, that should be honored when we go to a pace car or whatever it might be. Okay, I get that. You're wanting to absolutely protect the honor and integrity of the race, but that honor and integrity is completely lost when we see teams going a lap down because, again, randomness in where they were on track and which pace car they fell behind. So the purity angle to me gets lost when you go, okay.
I'm afraid
the all-inclusive.
The option, by the way, if that purity argument is being fielded by the rule makers, I'm afraid they've lost that opportunity to field that on the basis that they're now managing it far more directly in other ways. Yes, I can see it from the enthusiast, the fans' point of view about that. But the reality here is, look, we want a fair result. We want a result. There've been too many results of races in recent years where I've come away feeling I should be really enthusiastic about that. And for whatever reason, I'm not. I don't want to feel about that. I want to be joyful about the results that you see, whether or not it's a team that you hold dear or a driver that you kind of have got the cap or the T-shirt from. Ryan Eversley for me all the time, every time. Evan Risley, by the way, is definitely going to be a thing. But it's for me, we do. There's a moment. That moment can be now where we take a step away and think, what have we got now? Is this ticking the boxes? In very many ways, it really, really isn't. And I think that needs some serious consideration. There is, you know, before anybody says it's knocking the WEC or it's knocking it, it's not. I'll be absolutely honest with you. I don't think there's a single...
We love this stuff. We just want it to be the best it can be.
There is no perfect solution anywhere on the planet at all. You know, I'd be very happy whether or not there's a race director in the room or not, to tell them and tell anybody else what my point of view is as to why what they're doing isn't perfect and isn't working for me as an observer, as a fan. Forget what I do for a living. As a fan, happy to do that. Have done that in many instances with some of those guys. But the reality at the moment is I genuinely think there's a moment here. Forget the FIA. You know, forget that. Let's deal with the people who are actually really involved in the grassroots running of these races. Involve the marshals. Involve the race control staff. Involve some of the competitors. Involve some of the observers. And let's have a real debate about what works, what doesn't. Where does safety prevail? Where does competition prevail? Where does common sense prevail? Where does everything like that have its part in it? And I've been a firm exponent of this. You get smart people in a room and you put a whiteboard in the corner. You start making notes about good ideas that come forward. And even if there's 100 ideas on there and only two are deliverable, you've not wasted your time, because those people are having a conversation. Those people have got that relationship. Those people have got a bit more trust. We need a bit more of that. We need a bit less master and servant and a bit more family. This is the endurance racing family. This is the motorsport family. And that family is awesome.
I just came up with a perfect solution, though. starting in 2019, the 24 Hours of Le Mans will be run on the short Le Mans Bugatti circuit. There you go. It's fixed. Well, we're done.
It's easy. No? What, you could always put the GTM class on the Bugatti.
I'm thinking the kart track for the GT.
Well, yeah, but don't run the prototypes to the full circuit and maybe run GTLM because it should be more difficult in the opposite direction.
See, problem solved. We're so smart. All right. Two more questions, and I have to run and truly run, which is a comical thing to view. First, I'll go with Michael Goodyear on Twitter, who said, any rumors to talk in the paddock regarding who will be calling the IMSA races on NBCSN next season? Not sure if I missed this information, or maybe it's still in the works and hasn't been discussed yet publicly. I did reach out to a couple of friends who I think will be part of the IMSA NBC commentating and pit reporting lineup, Michael, and they said there's been nothing coming back. I think the general feeling is let's get through the existing WeatherTech Championship season before we really burrow into who's going to do what. I know that, you know, this might sound crazy, but I have an aspiration to be a part of it in some way, shape, or form. Not to take a job away from those who do that full time, but is there something I can add on the side or do something a little bit special there? Maybe on the technical side, maybe on the historical side, who knows? But one thing I do know for sure is I'm hoping that all of the existing Fox Sports crew is carried over to a new home at NBCSN, and with some good folks at NBCSN as well, who are maybe have a little bit of extra time with the open wheel products that they cover. I have a feeling we're going to see a lot of familiar faces, hear some familiar voices, and there should be some additions there, but I think it's all going to be in a positive direction, not like, all right, that person doesn't belong other than me. Let's leave the final question here for Andrew Baca. Good old Baxter here. He says, if IMSA were to renege on their promises to BOP the DPI cars to match a P2 pace in order to unleash the DPIs, what concessions should be given to the P2s to compensate? And Andrew says, in my opinion, the DPI manufacturers should be required to sell two customer chassis for the cost-capped P2 price. Love that idea. Starting from the second year of their program, also love that. He says that gives at least the full-time teams the option to upgrade and still compete for overall wins at no additional cost, keeping the original promise mostly intact. What do you think, Graham? What do the P2s get?
I think that's, well, number one, I think that's a brilliant idea. The numbers you could put to one side, but I think that's an absolutely excellent idea in terms of if you've got manufacturer involvement. I know it's a principle that I know they're trying to build into the new LMP1 rules about effectively cost capping supply to customers at the powertrain of the factory cars. And I think more and more, that's a kind of method to restrict the opportunities for the manufacturers to go bananas with development. What could they do with the P2? There's lots of things they could do, whether or not they wish to and will do. Could you give them more freedom in terms of changing suspension? You could, but they're not going to, is the absolute honest truth of the matter. I would be surprised if the debate about splitting those two classes hadn't at least had a semicolon inserted after the last couple of races. It looked terribly simple, didn't it, until we all rocked up to Watkins Glen. And then after a Canadian Tire Motorsport Park, it looked less simple again. The debate for me is actually around two things. It's the power in that debate of the privateer LMP2 teams, and the power in that debate and the manufacturers and the sponsors that sit behind the DPI. And I'm terribly sorry, but in that debate, the privateers are going to lose. You've therefore got to decide whether or not you're going to retain most of those people by keeping them in a P2 class, or you give them the opportunity at a limited cost to upgrade their machinery or obtain new machinery to DPI specification. I think Andrew's idea there has got huge merit.
To answer your question directly, Andrew, I think the suspension side, that's the one thing that teams have been crying for, to have that open so that they can do their own in-house damper development or buy leading-edge damping solutions. There is definite speed and performance to be found there, not just in cornering, But the one area I would say that is the biggest complaint of deficiencies from the Spec P2 teams, and that is a lack of torque coming off of the corners in the slower corners. I mean, truly the slower second gear, maybe third. The ability from a damping standpoint to assist the car in how it squats down and puts down its power. That's an area that can help. That's an area that can mitigate some. I'm not talking about a huge change, but you can certainly help the WEC P2 with their Gibson V8 to put down the power better and more effectively if damping was an area that teams could really dive into. The only downside to that, if we're looking at P2 being a cost-capped class, as we have seen and heard evidence of in IndyCar, some of the new teams coming in this season thinking, hey, that's cool, you know, damping's the one area that's truly open for IndyCar teams to play with. Some of the new teams have had serious sticker shock, Graham, when they tried going with, kind of normal dampers that they thought would work, and found out that not only were they getting completely roasted by the veteran teams, but buying in to that cutting-edge damping world, it's $100,000 to $120,000 per set. Massive. And so if you've got multiple cars, you're going to want multiple sets because you're going to want to build different damping configurations to try out. We're talking about costs where you go, should I buy a spare tub or and bodywork, or should I get another set of these little damper thingies? So suspension's the area that teams have been calling for or wanting to have opened. Not inexpensive, though. It's certainly going to open up a big price point to do that, but it would also help. At least in the one performance area that I mentioned, and they would also, in theory, be faster in the corners if they could get into the damping side too. Beyond that, I don't know how much more you could get into things from an aero standpoint. If there were more aero tuning options, that might be something to consider, something that's been completely locked down. So whether it would be more dive planes or et cetera, a little bit more tuning. Tuning options is never a bad thing, provided the costs aren't crazy. So I think if the WEC P2 teams, Andrew, could further refine their aero and maybe could get into the damper game a little bit more than they are right now, those are the things that would probably satisfy. After that, Graham, I mean, what are you going to do? Ask Gibson to give them a scramble mode for the naturally aspirated V8 that gives it an extra 1,000 RPM? I mean, I think that would be maybe a little bit too far in capability. So I think the formula has been painted into a fairly tight tight window.
Yeah, short of Larry Holt, the Multimatic guys, opening up a trackside stall selling damper packages, I'm not really sure there's an easy way forward for this, but I strongly suspect that the final determinant will be somewhat more blunt.
Well, I think we have the answer right there. We're going to wrap this first ever two-part broken into two episode Week in Sports Cars, presented by Cooper Tires and supported this month by the Justice Brothers. I think what we really need to do is I'm going to privately crowdfund a set of $120,000 dampers to put on my 24 Hours of Le Mans entry for Racer Magazine, so we surely kick Daily Sports Cars' butt.
Yeah, well, that'd be fine, but we're going to go to Gibson and get a P2 engine for ours.
Damn it! All right, my friend. Well, enjoy the Red Bull Ring this weekend, and we'll look forward to coming back next week with IMSA at Lime Rock to discuss, ELMS to discuss, and who knows, Pirelli World Challenge might come out with a radically different set of 2020 rules for us to discuss. Until then, I'm Marshall Pruitt, that is Graham Goodwin, and thank you for listening.